Hi, this is Bob Sorrentino from Italian Roots and Genealogy, and I'm here today with Brett Tommen, and we're going to talk a little bit about his family history and also the St. Francis pilgrimages. So welcome, Brett. Thanks for being here.
Hey, Bob. Thanks for having me. It's a real pleasure.
So we were talking before, you're in Atlanta right now, but do you go back and forth between Atlanta and Italy, or how's that work?
Yeah, back and forth, mostly back, I'll say. I live in Italy full time and I come to visit here. So I'm outside of Atlanta in a little town called Peachtree City, which is just south of the Hartsfield Airport. And this is where I'm from. So I'm staying with my dad. And I got here a couple days ago. My daughter, she's turning 18. She's looking at universities. And so we're here doing that. So other than that, I live in Italy. I live in Loreto. It's on the Adriatic coast. That'd be the eastern coast. And I've got three children, my oldest daughter, a 15-year-old boy, and then a 5-year-old boy. And we love it over there. So we've been there about 8.5, going on 9 years.
I'm jealous.
Well, I tell you, right now, I'm happier here in Atlanta. The weather over there is just kind of gloomy and foggy. But in March, between April and early November, there's no place I'd rather be. It's just gorgeous to be over there. And we're right on the water. I bought a little sailboat, learned how to sail a couple of years ago. A little dinghy, a racing dinghy. And yeah, I love it. I love it.
So the obvious question is, why did you wind up there?
Well, people have asked me that before, and I always just say one step at a time. So I went to University of Georgia back in the early 90s, and I had to study a foreign language. So I signed up for Italian, and I thought about Spanish or French. I had taken Spanish in high school. I thought it was kind of easy. French, I thought, was a little pretentious. But Italian, I thought, was pretty cool because I liked the Godfather trilogy movies. I liked Italian food, and I thought Italian girls were pretty. So that was about the depth of my decision-making process when I was a 19-year-old college kid. But there was a little bit more to it than that. I have some Italian relatives, some Italian genealogy, and I think probably, well, not everybody, but a lot of people in America do because there's so much immigration, 50 to 100 years ago. So I have some roots that came from northern Italy near Genoa, and they emigrated in the late 1800s, 1866, I believe it was. And they settled in San Francisco. So their last name was Bacigalupi. And my grandmother, who's deceased now, her last name is Bacigalupi. So she's the last one who carried that last name, that surname. So I knew I had these kind of Italian roots, 4 generations back, but I felt some kind of connection to it. So I think there's a little bit more than the, pizza and pasta and girls that when I started to study Italian, I wanted to, I don't say connect with my roots, but there was something there. So I studied Italian. And after I did the Italian 101, 102, and 103, I signed up for a study abroad program in Florence, Italy, because I'd never been out of the country. My dad was an airline pilot, so I could kind of travel around. Excuse me. I traveled all over the U.S. flying, standby and non-revenue, but I'd never been outside the country. So I did that. And that's really when kind of the change took place, because I really fell in love with the country and the history and the culture. And I was in Florence for 2 months. And when I came back, the way the university gave me credit for that study abroad program is they gave me the next successive credits in the from Italian 103 on up. So I ended up getting one Italian 201 course and then 3 course level on the 300 level. So I was almost halfway there to the major. So I kind of took an easy road out. I said, I'll just major in Italian because I only need 5 more courses. Did it, kind of took it easy, got the coursework. And then after I graduated from undergraduate degree, with my undergraduate degree in Italian, I said, what am I going to do now? So I decided to do a master's degree in Italian. I went through Middlebury College, which is closer up to where, your neck of the woods up in Vermont than where I am down here in Georgia. And I did a master's and we lived in Florence for a year. And that's when I really got deep into the language and the culture. And I learned how to speak it very fluently at that point, learned about all the the literary tradition, the artistic tradition, traveled extensively throughout Italy. That's when I really became Italian, I think. And during that process of those studies, I met a girl named Katia, Caterina, And we were friends for a number of years. But after I'd come back and started looking for Italian jobs down here in Georgia, and there were none, I decided to follow my father in his footsteps, and I became an airline pilot. And just before I was supposed to start training, I went back to Italy and down to southern Italy, where I'd spent a summer doing some volunteer work. And I ran into Katia again, and we hadn't seen each other in about 5 years, and we hit it off. So it was kind of a boy re-meets girl moment. And we got married about 2.5 years after that. And so she had never been outside of Italy when we got married. She'd never, before she met me the second time, she'd never been outside of the country. She came to the U.S., here to Atlanta, stayed here in my little town of Peachtree City. And we just kind of took, you know, things one step at a time, got married. We lived here for about 10 years. While I was flying, and we started also organizing some travel and some pilgrimages. And then during that time, we said, we really want to move back over to Italy. And she was from the South, but she lived in Assisi for about 6 years, 6 or 7 years. And we wanted to go back to central Italy. So we have some friends who are some friars, OFM secular, from the Order of Friars Minor, Franciscans, and also some nuns, some third order nuns, Franciscan nuns. And they had a retreat center in Loreto. And Katia had been friends with them since her days living in Assisi. And so they invited us to come back where they were to help out with their retreat center, just to be there, and also to kind of make that our headquarters for our travel business. So that's what brought us back there 8.5 years ago, almost 9 years ago. And we weren't thinking about living there long term. We were thinking about doing an experience for maybe 6 months, a year. We wanted our kids, so we had two at that point, to learn the language and also learn the culture and kind of experience a different kind of life, because you know how things are in the U.S. It's very fast paced, and we live kind of in a materialistic area. There's lots of pilots here, and there's, you know, my wife is not used to all of that kind of lifestyle. So we wanted to give them sort of a simpler lifestyle and introduce them to it. And that was now almost 9 years ago. So we're there now, and but we still have one foot here in the U.S., or at least I do, more so than my wife. My daughter, who I'm here with now, I said at the beginning, we're looking at colleges for her. She grew up here and went to school here through third grade. So she feels a connection to the U.S. also, but she also feels Italian because she's lived there half her life. Actually, just 1 year more than half her life, she's lived in Italy. So she feels both Italian and American. So she's kind of in a bind to what she wants to do, whether she wants to go to college in Italy or college here.
Yeah, wouldn't it be so much cheaper for her to go there? Or for you.
Yes, it would. And you're right, it would. And there's drawbacks to the Italian university system as well, drawbacks. It's a different kind of a system. It's very academic, very focused on rigor studies. They don't really do much extracurricular. There's no extracurricular college life. There really aren't campuses. So there's no, you know, sports teams, clubs. It's all just about studies. It's study, study, study. And that's how the high schools are too. It's very rigorous. So she's a good student, but she has some system challenges in some certain areas. So she just always had in her mind that she would go to college here. And also a lot of her childhood friends, now they're all going to college. So she sees them on Instagram and kind of keeps in touch with them. And so she just, you know, it's the same thing. The grass is greener on the other side. So she feels like she wants to come back here.
Well, but to answer your question. You have to go you can't control them after a certain point. So
I'm trying to guide at this point and, you know, help her make things. She's got some money set aside. Said, look, Emery, this is the money you have. You can spend it here. You can spend it there. Once you get beyond that, you're taking out loans. And, so if you want to do it more economically, there's other options. But we'll see. She's a smart girl, I think.
So since you're an Italian scholar, what advice do you have for someone like me? I mean, I grew up hearing Italian. My grandparents were all Italian, and my mom and dad spoke it with their parents, but they didn't teach us, unfortunately. And I struggle all the time. I try to learn. I stop. I start. So what advice would you give to somebody like me who at least wants to be, I don't have to be fluent, but I want to be able to understand stuff?
We'll be right back.
Italian Roots and Genealogy is proudly sponsored by Your Dolce Vita and Dawn Matera, connecting people to their purpose in life and continuing their legacy. For more information, contact Dawn at www.yourdolcevita.com.
Well, Well, you may have already been doing these. You know, there's online, all kinds of online sites that you can use for learning the, well, you're not learning the basics, you're going beyond that. I would say for someone starting off to go find an online site and just you know, work with the speaking part, not so much the grammar, because the schools always focus on grammar, and it's kind of grammar is part of speaking, but you know, when children learn how to speak, we don't teach our children grammar. We have a 5-year-old at home. He's speaking both English and Italian, and I speak with him in English. My wife speaks him in Italian. He goes to school in Italian, so he speaks both languages. But I never once told him about grammar. So children learn languages by speaking, not by classroom, you know, rote conjugating verbs. So if you can find some kind of conversation class online, and then up in New Jersey, I'm sure there's Italian clubs and groups that you can join into, speaking groups, and because you really want to do the speaking part. Like you probably don't care about the pluperfect tense of the IRE conjugated verbs
No.
and the passato remoto and all of those things. You know, when you go get a master's degree, you have to learn all that stuff. But it was really when I was in Italy with you know, guys and girls in restaurants and nightclubs or playing volleyball and you know, taking walks after going to to and from pizzerias. That's where I learned how to speak Italian. So that applies for adults, although our you know, linguists say that our brain, the language part of our brain, has formed in a different way than children. So we learn in a different way. But at the same time, you know, as I said before, we don't teach kids grammar, children grammar. We just speak to
Yes.
them.
So
So
let
you
me
want to
ask you, because
speak.
I've been watching. I stumbled upon this. She's really fantastic. Her name is Marina, Marya. She pronounces it Marina, and she has these great videos on YouTube. She's got like 1.5 million followers. She's a great singer, and she does these funny skits. And I've been watching those, and you know, kind of, you know, catching on to some of the things when she, you know, when she speaks Italian, or sometimes I'll put the little translation underneath there.
Sure.
To your point, are you supposed to try and translate, or are you supposed to try and just learn it?
Well, I think when we get to a certain age, we want to translate because,
Yeah.
again, that part of our brain that has is formed in a particular language is solidified. That's one of the reasons why we have accents, because the part of the brain that controls the muscles of the mouth and the tongue is formed after about 12 or 13 years of age. So
Really?
children who learn a language before 11 or 12 generally don't have foreign accent. If they learn it after, they do. So when I speak Italian, I have a strong, I have an American accent. Sometimes it's stronger, sometimes it's not as strong. But I think that's a part, and I'm not a linguist, I'm not an expert in this. I've just read a little bit here and there, kind of dabbled in it. I think that's what happens when you get to a certain age, is that you're thinking in English, and so you hear Italian and you just want to sort of translate it into English. I think in both languages, I talk in both languages, I probably dream in both languages, but English is my predominant language. I mean, you hear the way I speak like a normal American, maybe with a slight southern accent here or there. So this is where I grew up, and I hear you the way you speak, Bob. You speak like you're from New Jersey. I wouldn't say New Jersey, I would say somewhere north of Maryland or somewhere up there.
Actually,
But that's just how
Queens.
we are, and it's part of the way our brains form and that our language forms with it. But I will say this: if you grew up with hearing Italian in the house, then you have an advantage that I didn't, because I was 19 the first time I heard anything beyond ciao or you know arrivederci, and I didn't have any exposure to it. So if you already had that, it affected the way your mind was learning and forming. So you have sort of a little bit more of an innate a knack for going farther with the language. And I want to ask you this too, though, what language were they speaking? I suspect they were speaking probably a southern dialect, something around Campania or Naples.
They were speaking two different dialects, actually. My mom was speaking Barese, which
Okay.
is way out there.
Well,
And my
that's what my
dad
wife
was,
speaks. My wife speaks her dialect. She's from Taranto. She's from the province of Taranto, a town called Mottola, which is halfway between Bari and Taranto. They're in geographically, they're in the province of Taranto, but their dialect and culture is more Barese. My wife would probably, I'm not, I'm sure she would. She would understand your parents if she heard them speak. And she speaks the dialect also.
And my dad's family was from Naples. So
Yeah,
my
Napoli
mom
Dom.
and dad used to, You're not speaking right. But I have, and I just learned this not too long ago. I have cousins, second cousins in Toronto. My grandmother's brother was an admiral in the Navy, and it's a big naval base in Toronto, so he was down there. And the whole family was there, and I'm hoping we're going to see them this year. We met some of the other family last year, but we want to go to Toronto and go to Torito. That's where my grandmother was from, my grandmother and grandfather. Torito and now, Acquaviva della
Fonte. Most of southern Italy, Naples historically there was a kingdom of Naples, and southern Italy was ruled from Naples. So the Neapolitan dialect was really widespread throughout all of southern Italy. So my wife, she can understand Neapolitans when they speak dialect, not the pure Neapolitan dialect, but the basic Neapolitan dialect she can speak. So if one parent was speaking Barese and one was speaking Napolitano, as long as they weren't speaking the pure dialect form, they could understand one another's dialects.
Yeah, and they did, and they certainly understood each other, no question about that. So I want to ask you about the pilgrimages. So how did that come all about, and what do you do with these pilgrimages?
So when Katya and I got married, we were living here in Atlanta, south of Atlanta. She had lived in Assisi for 6 years, 7 years, and got very close to the Franciscan friars and nuns, as I said before. So when we were here in Atlanta, she wanted to continue that sort of Franciscan experience, journey, spirituality. So she looked up the Third Order of St. Francis, the secular Franciscan order, and there's a fraternity, a group of lay people who follow a rule of Franciscan spirituality approved by the church. The original rule was written by St. Francis, but over the centuries now it's changed somewhat. So there's a fraternity that meets here in Jonesboro, not far from where we live, kind of the other side of the airport. And she started going. I started going with her not long after, because I have a deep affinity for St. Francis. That first summer I was studying in Florence, we went to Assisi on a day trip, and I was Protestant. I never heard of St. Francis, didn't know anything about him. We went on a tour through the Basilica of St. Francis, and the professor, you know, talked about the life story of Francis, and he really inspired me, and he just had such a powerful conversion experience and a love of God that I never really heard of before. He gave away everything he owned to live with poor people. And really struck me. So I had kind of this affinity for St. Francis, and I converted and became Catholic, and I took St. Francis as my confirmation name. Yeah. So when she started going to the Third Order meeting, I started going shortly after, and we made professions, lifelong profession in the secular Franciscan order, and we kept going with it. And then about a year or so after we started the formation, I had an idea that we could bring English-speaking people over to Assisi, Rome, Laverna, Rieti, these places that were associated with the life of Francis, and kind of walk them through the footsteps of St. Francis. So I'm American, but I'm also became an Italian citizen about 6 or 7 years after I got married to Katya through my wedding to her. And so I'm Italian and American, you know, speak English, but also speak Italian. Catholic American, but also have a love of St. Francis. So all these things kind of came together. And we just started at the beginning, bringing groups of people from this area over to Assisi, didn't charge much, kind of what it cost. And then it sort of started to grow a little bit. People wanted to go to Rome. People wanted to go down to Southern Italy, to Padre Pio and places like that, started to increase. And it became sort of a Catholic pilgrimage company, but I kept the name St. Francis Pilgrimages. And initially I didn't think it was going to be a full-time kind of pilgrimage endeavor. It was just sort of a thing I did with a handful of people once or twice a year. But then after about 2 years, it became a full-time business. And it slowed down with the pandemic, actually stopped for 2 years during the pandemic, but now it's starting back up. I'm getting calls again. So we do still pilgrimages in the footsteps of St. Francis is kind of the thrust of what we do, but also Catholic pilgrimages throughout Italy. We go to the Holy Land sometimes. I've been to France, Spain, Portugal, Medjugorje. But predominantly Italy. And we also do sort of walking caminos. You've probably heard of the Way, you know, the Camino of Santiago in Spain, northern Spain, that goes to the Compostela, where St. James's relics are. In Italy, there's a number of caminos, these walking pilgrimages, including one called the Way of St. Francis, or the St. Francis Camino. It goes from Assisi down to Rome. You can start up north of Assisi in Laverne and walk down to Assisi. This is pretty rigorous. There's lots of hills and mountains. The Apennine Mountains run through there, so you have to be in pretty good shape. days are long. There's lots of climbs. So we do that a little bit. I've got this year four or five groups, mostly small groups, coming to do that. And then individuals come. I help people put together, you know, itineraries, or if they're coming by themselves or with a, you know, a spouse or a family. So I help people do that. And also been writing too. So during the pandemic, I started writing more, and I just published a book, literally just came out a couple of days ago. It's on Amazon, and it's called Following Padre Pio. And what I did was I went down to Pietrocina in Campania, where Padre Pio was born, and I spent 5 days there. And then I went out each day to several of the 10 friaries or convents where he lived, even for short periods of time, before he went to San Giovanni Rotondo. When he got to San Giovanni Rotondo, he received the stigmata and he lived there for 50 years. But there's 10, about nine places before there where he lived, and not much is known about these places. So I wrote a book about the life of Padre Pio, and then I went out and visited all 10 friaries, and I wrote about my journey going to these places. I didn't know what to expect. I'd never been there before. And I just did this back in October, and I just published it. So anyway, it just came out a couple of days ago. So I write some books like that. I've got one or two other books on Padre Pio, some books on the St. Francis Camino, a book on St. Maria Goretti, and a few others like that. And so I translate some books also. So I've been keeping busy, even though the pilgrimage business has been slow. I've been keeping busy with other things.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, I had my first book published in October. So
congratulations. It's
quite an experience. I'll make sure I put the Amazon link for everybody to see. And my book is Great. Farmers and Nobles, because my father's mother was from a noble families, and my mother was from farmers.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah, my grandmother was Piermalo and Caracciolo.
Great.
And you've obviously been to the Vatican. You've seen the tomb of Pope Paul the Third, I assume.
Paul the Third, where is that? Is
it it's in the all upper the way, room? Kind of all the way in the back somewhere.
In the main nave?
In the main, yeah, okay. In the main.
Well, I probably walked by it. I'm not sure if I've specifically noticed that one.
Well, he's my 13th great-grandfather.
Whoa, no kidding. Paul the Third. Was he Paul in the Renaissance? Third. What yes. What era was he from?
He was, yeah.
Counter-Reformation.
He was, he commissioned Michelangelo to finish the Sistine Chapel. And
okay, so the 1550s, Council of Trent, 40s, something like that.
He was in the Council of Trent, I think he was. And he excommunicated Henry VIII.
Okay, so mid-16th century. Yeah. Paul III.
Yeah.
Was he a canonized a saint?
No, he was not. I don't know if you saw the Borgia series about Alexander.
Yeah, well, like some of it, a little bit.
Yeah. Well, he was Alessandro Farnese, and his sister was Alexander's girlfriend.
Okay, so he was one of the last of the Renaissance popes, because if you look at the sainted popes and the non-sainted popes, none of the Renaissance popes are sainted. And then once the Counter-Reformation kicks in, the first one is sainted and canonized, and then they're all canonized after that. So he was one of the last of the lines of the more worldly Renaissance popes, it sounded like. Yeah, I've seen the name for sure.
Yeah, he's not in my grandmother's line per se, but he is, you know, some sort of distant relative. But in the Duomo in Naples, there's a statue for St. Francis Caracciolo, and he's a distant kind All right. of relative of sorts. The interesting thing when we're watching the Borgias, and you know, I'm sitting there with my wife, and I'm saying these. Because he was made a cardinal at the age of 18,
right?
Because he was the Pope's girlfriend's nephew, brother,
probably, or something. Yeah, there was a lot of nepotism and things like that in that period.
And he wasn't made Pope until he was 67. He was hanging around the Vatican
pretty
for
old
like
back
50
then.
Years. Yeah.
Okay.
Interesting story. But we digress. So
that's okay. Very interesting.
If anybody wants to, take the tour, how do they get in touch with you, and where would they find you?
Well, my website is stfrancispilgrimages.com. So St. Francis, not S-A-I-N-T, stfrancispilgrimages.com. Or if they Google my name, it'll come up. My name is Brett, Brett Thoman, Thoman. And like I said, we do some group pilgrimages, but since the pandemic, I haven't been doing them as much. But I do a lot of individual work with a lot of individuals, people coming over, helping them put together their programs, making recommendations, even guiding. So I'll go down to Rome and guide around Rome, definitely Assisi, even Florence, and so forth. Yeah, so I definitely do that with people.
And before we go, I just have to ask you, because I'm going to assume that your dad's family has been in the States for a long time. Am I right or am I wrong?
So the Batch of Galupi is on my mom's side, and my father's side, Thoman, has been in the States since the 1500s. According to my grandmother, my paternal grandmother, who died 10, 8, 8 or 9 years ago, they came from Alsace-Lorraine, that region between France and Germany, in the 1500s. So yeah, they came early, and they went to New Jersey, as a matter of fact. They settled in New Jersey. My dad was born in New Jersey, and then his father, my grandfather, moved down to Florida, South Florida, when he was a boy, and he grew up in Florida. But the Thomans, yeah, the 1500s went from Alsace-Lorraine to New Jersey. And there, we still have a lot of Thomans up there in New Jersey now.
Oh yeah, that's interesting. I kind of figured that they were
That's
around.
right.
I don't know why. My two kids are adopted, and my daughter's family goes back to both her birth mother and father go back to the 1600s. So
Oh, wow.
they came
Yeah.
very early, but they came into Virginia and
Okay.
North Carolina, and then went south from there to South Carolina and
Okay.
Georgia, and eventually into Florida. But she's got, I was able to trace her back through, she's a direct from Daniel Boone.
Oh, no
And
kidding.
yeah, and the interesting thing, I never knew this, Daniel Boone is a direct from Captain Morgan the pirate.
Huh? How
So,
about
you
that?
find these crazy things out as you do
Yeah,
this
sure do.
research.
That's right.
So
Good.
and obviously, I guess your ancestors probably were in the Revolution and the Civil War and all that kind
Yeah,
of
well,
stuff.
they lived through it. I don't know if they were in it, but I don't know too much about my Thoman side. And really, I did a little bit of looking into my Batch of Galupi side when I wrote my last book on becoming Italian, too. So I wrote that at the beginning, I started at the beginning of the pandemic when we were in lockdown. And I'm sure you know, Bob, and a lot of your listeners, that Italy kind of went into the pandemic first, and then we were locked down hard first. So it was a very surreal period. So I just started writing because I had nothing else to do. We were locked in our homes. And I started doing some research, and I wrote my book, Becoming Italian, telling some of the stories I told a little bit today, but about how, a kid from Georgia with the last name Thoman becomes Italian, lives in Italy, and leads groups throughout Italy. But it was a lot of fun. But yeah, my relatives left from Genoa, and they sailed, down around the Cape of Good Hope, and then all the way around to the West Coast, and landed in San Francisco. And that was in the 1860s. And one of them became a dry goods, ran a dry goods store. The other had some land and was a farmer. So
And
yeah, there's a lot of people from Genoa went to San Francisco because they a lot of them had experience in the shipyards, and then they worked in the port in San Francisco. And it was kind of a chain migration thing. So cousins went, sent letters back home saying, "Hey, you guys got to come. We got jobs for you." Cousins came and then expanded from there. So there were a lot of people from Genoa in San Francisco. Even today, well, I was going to say today, when I was a kid, I was out there one time. We were talking about the last name Bacigalupi. And the other one is Bacigalupo. Bacigalupo, Bacigalupi are kind of both from that area of Genoa. And we opened up the phone book back when you had phone books in the Bay Area. They were living in Redwood City. And there was a whole list of Bacigalupos and Bacigalupis in that area. So there were a lot of people from that area that came over. And in Genoa, Liguria, Bacigalupo sounds like a funny last name, but that's as common as Smith or Johnson, in the United States. Very common surnames. But anyway, Bay Area is full of Bacigalupis and Bacigalupos and Genovese and Ligurians.
That must have been some god-awful trip in 1860.
Oh my gosh. And they were in steerage class, so that would be like third class. with no beds, no seats, just kind of sleeping on the floor. Yeah, no kidding. And you don't have weather forecasts. You don't have meteorology. You just kind of go. I imagine it took a long, long time.
I don't know
if it was a steamship. It may have been a steamship. Otherwise, it probably is a steamship. I think that.
Yeah, it could have been early steamship. Yeah.
They were just transitioning around that time.
Yeah. Wow, that's amazing. I'd love to hear that story.
Well, I thought they went through, you know, to New York, Ellis Island, and they traveled across the country on stagecoach. But no, my aunt told me, she told me, no, they took a ship all the way around and went straight to California. They didn't have the Panama Canal then, so you had to go all the way down south of South America, the Cape of Good Hope.
Incredible. Unbelievable. Well, listen, Brett, I really appreciate you taking the time. And
Bob.
We'll get your information out there. Anybody interested in taking the tours, they'll know how to get in touch with you. And we'll stay in touch.
Okay. And the last one, Becoming Italian is the last one that I wrote. That might be interesting to some of your listeners too, with the genealogy and so forth.
Yeah, absolutely. And we'll put the links out there for sure.
Ciao, I am Marino Caracciolo II, Prince of Avellino, Duke of Tripalda, Count of Serino and Marquis of San Severino. I was born in Tripalda in 1587 and died in 1630. My family dates back to the 10th century in Naples, Italy. This is my 8th great-grandson Roberto Sorrentino. Can you see how much looks like my born centuries apart? Roberto has been researching his Italian roots for 20 years. His grandmother Maria Luigia Piromallo comes from the noble Piromallo and Caracciolo di Torchiarolo families. Roberto's maternal family comes from Toritto, Bari in Puglia. They were honorable hardworking farmers. Roberto has written a book about his research and ancestors from both families and urge you to purchase a copy from his website www.italiangenealogy.blog, Amazon, Doubleday or direct from Genai Publishing.